Well, thank you for coming. Can everybody hear me in the room and online? Wonderful to see so many people online and here in person. As Jim said, this will be our second talk during this little more intensive period we have each first part of the year called Kilche. And as he mentioned, there's a practice that comes down to us all the way back to Buddha called practicing the paramitas. And as Jim mentioned, paramita is usually translated into English as perfection. So before we go any further, I think the intent of it in our practice, which we'll all be appreciative of, it's not meant to say you need to be perfect. It's really the practice of perfecting yourself on this Zen path. It's an ongoing process. There are occasionally great leaps. There are baby steps. There are many, many times it will feel like one step forward and one step back. That's all part of the program. So these perfections, which we're looking at one by one, really give us some ideas about how we can actually move particularly our behavior in the direction of being clear and compassionate. And wherever we're on that, we'll find that we have incredible number of opportunities moment by moment to actually be helpful, use this clarity and use this compassion towards others in a helpful way. That equally applies to us. We're included in that. We started our practice today by reciting the four great vows, which essentially help us kind of renew our sense of direction, being very patient with ourselves, but having compassion for ourselves while we're also working on moving in the direction, if it's not too high a bar, towards Buddhahood. Not to be necessarily fully realized in every moment, but it's almost as if, doctors practice medicine. It's never perfect, but they have a commitment to moving in the direction to fulfill their Hippocratic oaths. So, don't worry about the fact that none of us are perfect, right? That's number one, which applies to all of the paramitas. All of the paramitas are related to one another. So while we're looking at them one by one, don't forget that they kind of form a whole. And if you can actually look at the individual parts, and also as we go through Kilche, every other week we'll be looking at a different paramita. But please don't forget that these form a whole, which will give you a lot of insights into what Zen practice is about. This paramita that we're looking at today, the Sanskrit word is sila paramita. 2 weeks ago, we looked at Dana Paramita, and that's the practice of generosity. Pretty easy in that case to translate Dana into the word generosity. Sila is a little squishier. There are different facets of it, so we have to kind of circle around a little bit. I thought it would be interesting in preparing for this talk to look around in some of the books I have, talks that are given, Wikipedia entries about the Sila Paramita. And I kind of found somewhere between two or three different facets. One is it talks about morality, ethics. Sometimes it uses the word virtue, which has its own connotations in our culture. But it's primarily about behavior, conduct, the action we take in the world. So if you put these together, you see that you'll hear phrases like ethical behavior or virtuous conduct, things like that. That kind of defines the subject matter, but it doesn't go very far in terms of telling us how it can go about doing that. That's the real meat and potatoes of practicing this paramita. The third area, which feels initially kind of like an outlier, are words like discipline or training, and more specifically precepts, if you're aware of what precepts are. Many of you have taken precepts, and we'll get to that in a few minutes. But it's a recognition that trying to act in a moral, ethical way does take discipline. It's really easy for us to rationalize in any moment that, yeah, I should probably do that, but does it really matter? Does it really matter? So we kind of let things slide. The whole of Zen practice, if we take it seriously, also requires discipline, which we'll be getting to a little bit later. So I guess the most common English translation that you'll see is the word morality. And I bet there are some of you among us who kind of tighten up when we hear that morality, because it can feel maybe oppressive, maybe some outside authority making you act in a certain way that they deem moral. Maybe not. But if it is, one of the things I've been thinking about, which for those of you out there who might feel that, maybe we can think of sila as cultivation of character. It's more personal that way. We all want to be moral people, I bet. I'm not sure too many people come to a Zen center without wanting to be more kind, more caring to others, more helpful in this world that we have. So this paramita and all the paramitas are voluntary practices that we do. That doesn't mean Buddha didn't set up many guidelines. That doesn't mean we don't have some of those that we practice here in Seattle, Washington, and down in Long Beach, California, in any other place you might be. But there are things that we take on willingly if we choose to practice the paramitas. This is no easy task. I want to start, before we get into just looking at what the Sila Paramita consists of in a way, some of the things that we do here that come under this paramita. But, you know, starting from scratch, every morning we recite the four great vows. They're called four great bodhisattva vows. And in those vows, we vow to try to wake up and manifest our innate Buddha nature, as we call it. We're getting into some Zen language here. But we want to realize and manifest this nature in us that is wise and compassionate. And we want to do that so we can put it to good use to help other people, including ourselves, but other people. It doesn't take long after you start practicing, sitting in meditation, and you start seeing your own karma or the effects of your own karma. That's a Buddhist word for all of these factors that condition us. From the moment we're born, we inherit innumerable beliefs, opinions from our family, from our culture, from the place in the world where we're born. We have our own lens that we see the world through. And karma isn't inherently good or bad. But over time, these conditioned habits, we can become very attached to them without really seeing them clearly. And some of them are not helpful for us or other people. We see them as ingrained habit patterns. And I think at the root of it is this pervasive sense that this thing, that the so-called I, the so-called me, is separate from the world around us. So if we really act out as if this personal ego is the center of the universe, and we fail to see another equally true aspect of our, whatever we call this experience we're going through our life, if we fail to see this infinite, inseparable connection to all things, and only look out for number one, we create suffering all around us. And ultimately, that also creates suffering for ourselves. But we're very attached to these habit patterns, even the ones that we know don't serve us well and don't serve others well. As you continue to practice, the bar is set even higher when you realize that helping others is not limited to human beings. It includes absolutely everything. Animals, plants, insects, yes, rocks, mountains, oceans, rivers, deserts, our whole planet, in fact, the whole cosmos. How can we, so these vows we take, if we really look deeply into them, have no limit in time and space. Also, never to be perfected, but always to be practiced. Can we be compassionate towards whatever appears in front of us. I want to just to kind of talk about this is, I hope, I want to illustrate in a certain way that it is an ongoing activity we have to continually pay attention to by looking at another teaching of Buddha's. And the talk isn't about it, but it kind of illustrates the importance of practicing the Sila Paramita. And it's called the Three Poisons. Very, very early on, coming out of this attachment to ego, to me first, in which I have to protect this I that is largely a construct because it's always changing. I have to protect it, and I have to oppose any kind of threat to this ego. Along with that comes these three poisons that Buddha said lie at the root of suffering. And different words are used, but essentially they're greed, anger, and ignorance. So I want to look at them one by one. First of all, anger. I think we're all familiar with what it feels like when anger arises. Just experientially, our face gets flushed, our muscles tighten up, and we can literally feel that heat. And I think we can all pretty easily recall at least some of the damage that we've caused when we act out of this habit of anger. I should say, anger is a natural response, so don't feel like you cannot ever get angry. But how do we act out of that feeling of anger? How do we act out of that feeling of anger? Anger is immediate. It's like a flame. In fact, Buddha referred to these three poisons originally in terms of the metaphor of fire. There's heat involved, and it's pretty hard to see through that fire. And if we have a habit of giving way to anger in terms of our responses, which I think we all do, right? We sometimes do things that we really regret, deeply regret. So it causes suffering for us and for others at the same time. And when anger becomes a chronic habit pattern, it turns to hatred. And I don't think we need to look very far around this world right now to see how much hatred is manifesting in this world. So how do we tamp down the flames of anger? It has something to do with the Sila Paramita. The second one, greed, also has a burning quality of fire. It might arise as a burning desire for wealth, for fame, for sex, for adoration. I'm sure you can come up with many more of these things. But this greed, or we can also use the word lust, and that might help illustrate how it has, you know, we talk about burning passion. This is where our mind, instead of leaning away from a perceived enemy, leans towards something we think will complete this ego. We're completely convinced deep down. You can argue with me on this, but it'll be fun. deep, deep down, we don't believe that we are complete just as we are. So we grasp after things that we think will bring us eternal happiness, eternal adoration, eternal satiation of anything we think will bring us pleasure. And in the process as well, we co-opt others in the fulfillment of that. Not always, but when it's really out of control, there's collateral damage. And third, I want to talk about ignorance. Ignorance, to me, operates on a different level. And Buddha, in fact, talked about the fire of ignorance. He also used the word delusion. And I should say delusion has mental health connotations in the, our culture. But in when you read that word in talks or books about Buddhism, delusion is not seeing the wholeness of our existence, only our ego-based existence. We talk a lot here at Blue Heron about what Buddha called the two truths, the relative truth. That's the day-to-day truth. You're you and I'm me, and you're you and you're you and I'm me. But equally true, which we can directly experience or at least try on very seriously for size, is that you and I at the same time are also not separate at all. This is where true Buddhist compassion comes from. Seeing through that veil of separation that we carry around us to protect ourselves and not recognizing that we are, in fact, all one. Oneness, or we are the world, can sound like slogans, but there is a Buddhist insight to that that can really open up your the way you perceive where this individual person stands. We, Thich Nhat Hanh talks about interbeing. That's another word that's really nice. All, not just you and I as humans, again, but the whole cosmos interexists. Everything affects everything else. So the consequences of how things change matter. I talked earlier about different definitions of the Sila Paramita, and I can't help but circle back now that we've talked about this fire behind these three poisons to one of my favorite Zen masters to read, and that's Robert Aitken Roshi. And he mentions that, according to what he studied, he says that Sila literally means cool and peaceful. I think if we started saying, what is the Sila Paramita? Cool and peaceful. We'd all kind of be scratching our heads. But it really is taming those things for self preservation of the relative me that causes damage to the greater good. So what can we do about it? We're often unaware when we're acting out of our ingrained habit patterns, and often when we see the damage that we do, great damage or little damage, it's often too little too late. So how do we overcome it? That's what this paramita is about. again, going back to the formation of the early Sangha during Buddha's lifetime, he developed rules of conduct that would allow his fathers to cultivate wholesome attitudes and behaviors. Now, again, this pertains both to monastics and lay people. But for fully ordained monastics, living and practicing in a temple or in a very tight practicing community that is populated by people who have walked away from lay life and to really focus on this practice, they take hundreds of vows that govern nearly every aspect of their life, keeping the temple schedule, rules about not using other people's shoes, for example, not eating onions or garlic so you remained cool and peaceful rather than agitated, etc., etc. It's an outward structure that Buddha sent up and were followed and still are followed to this day, where the outside structure of the way a temple operates and the vows that monks and nuns take really keep them practicing this sila precept. Now, we're all lay people here in the United States who also have somehow had some kind of interest in Zen, and we come to a Zen center and we check it out to see if all the people here are just as strange as we feared they would be, or whether the teachings make any sense or they resonate with us. But we've taken some step towards continuing to live a lay life, but also look into this question of practice. So we have a much more trimmed down set of rules that we follow. And I'm not going to go into them, but I want to point them out to you so you're aware of them. One I've already mentioned, the four great vows. We vow essentially to realize this nature that's in us and encourage ourselves to manifest it so we can act with more generosity, with more being available to the needs of people outside of ourselves and emanating all the way out to include the entire world. The word sila is also sometimes literally translated as precepts. And so taking the precepts, which some of you may know what they are, some of you have taken them. Anybody wearing one of these brown kasa has taken precepts. Is central the practice of sila. And I want to say, I'm just going to talk about the first five precepts that we do, because we will have a precept ceremony at the end of April this year. So whether you plan to take precepts or are just curious to really understand what they're about and how they fit into our lives and practice, we'll have a workshop. When is it? March 10th? March 10th. Put that on your calendar. You don't have to, by walking in the door to the workshop does not mean that you have a group, you know, said, I want to take precepts, but it's that workshop will be a great way to really look more closely at it than we have time here. But the first five precepts are, I think, very fundamental things to guide us in our behavior. And they are, in the slightly old-fashioned language that we use at that ceremony, first to abstain from taking life. So killing, I vow not to kill. Second one, to abstain from taking things not freely given, stealing. Third, to abstain from misconduct done in lust. Now, that originally and still is a precept against sexual misconduct, which has a broad definition. It can refer to coercion that comes out of lust. Lust also can apply to non-sexual things, as we talked about before. Lust for power, lust for domination, lust for amassing wealth, lust for being everybody's favorite person, whatever it is. The fourth one is to abstain from lying. And the fifth one is to abstain from intoxicants taken to induce heedlessness. In other words, drunkenness. That can be drunkenness from alcohol or drugs. It can be drunkenness from your lust for power. So there are broader implications of these things. And one thing I will say is that certain branches on the Buddhist tree, the different kinds of practices, some groups take these vows absolutely literally. In Zen, we are admonished to know when to keep the precepts and when to not keep the precepts. So again, it puts the onus on us not to rationalize our behavior. This is very interesting. It's not an ultimately we practice so we can see for ourselves what is right and true and helpful. So lastly, the third aspect of sila that we sometimes forget are the temple rules. Again, going back to the monastic life, they have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of temple rules. But we also have temple rules that are in the back of our chanting book. And one of the first things we do at the beginning of every retreat is to recite them together. I can't tell you how full of wisdom, practical wisdom, the temple rules that come down to us are. They're very specific in so many ways, but they point to keeping a wide mind that's inclusive of everybody. And if you follow them, you can get, even just during the retreat, you can get down to the business of doing the retreat as opposed to creating kerfuffles everywhere and distractions. And it's also full of wisdom that you can apply to your life. So if you've never heard about the temple rules, you now have, and you know where to find them, the back of the chanting book. And I really urge you to read those and just let them wash over you. I refer to them all the time. It's one of my favorite parts of the beginning of the retreat, even though I have a long history of being pretty foggy-headed when we're starting early in the morning. So that's it. I'm going to leave you. Let's see. We're pretty much out of time, aren't we? Depending on how much time you have, we usually try to end at 11:30, which according to this clock means we have like 8 minutes. But I wanted to leave. I wanted to break into two groups like we did 2 weeks ago so we could kind of have a discussion about it. So if you have to leave at 11:30, don't feel compelled to stay. But if you want to kind of have a open discussion about this where we can ask questions and kind of share group wisdom, I have two questions. One, first one is a two-parter. And the question is, and I will hand, the question to you, Pope Saneem. Everybody, from me, that way we can go downstairs, and Jim, and you can take your pick. Chris Pope's name's group on this side of the room will stay up, and I'll hand you the questions. But the first one, and you don't have to be, you don't have to feel like you can't let the conversation go elsewhere. But the first one is, in Zen, we're told to know when to keep the precepts and when to break them. Why do we do that? And the second part of that is, how do we know when to keep the precepts and when to break them? This is a very central part to practicing the Sila Paramita. And the second question is, how does the Sila Paramita relate to the Dana Paramita, the Paramita of generosity that we talked about 2 weeks ago? So if you'd like to stay, if you're interested in it, we can do it. And if you have places you need to go, feel free to do it. Thank you.